That was Tenpole Tudor and Swords of a Thousand Men, preceded by This Town Ain't Big Enough for the Both of Us from Sparks. And this is Dr. Rock's radio show, coming to you live from the Avalon Rising Arena at this year's Green Gathering, which is looking like an absolutely fabulous gig. It's been very slow the last 3 or 4 years as they've struggled to break even. This year, I think they've sold a lot of tickets. It's already looking busier than it has before. Before I talk more generally about the festival itself and what's going on here, I've got Nolan Thacker with me, who's one of our main men helping to host the arena. Thanks for joining me, Nolan.
Thank you, Nick, for having me on.
And Nolan's here to talk about ether physics and free energy, and also about conscious community living, which, as many of you will know, is one of the main focuses of the Dr. Rock show. We realise that once the general state we're in unravels itself, we are going to need to learn how to live with each other, and that turns out to be a pretty challenging thing, doesn't it, Nolan?
It can be. I think that there's a lot of stuff that's going on with the community, and in general I've basically been looking at myself and how I fit in through my family into community, and trying to look for the ways and means in my life which are divergent to that, and the ways and means in my life which are convergent to that, and trying to understand those different energies and harmonies that are going on and disharmonies. And what I talk about and what I try and do in the events that I set up is, well, it's kind of my personal work, and the event is kind of around a reflection of where I am at this point, and the people I pull in are always a kind of a reflection of where I am at this point, and it becomes very interesting. The events are essentially based around the idea that if a space is held in the correct way, then people are inspired to fill it with their own talents. So for me, there's this thing with leadership. People keep telling me that I'm in a leadership role, which I've always denied being, any kind of a leader, because I feel that concept's incredibly unhelpful, because we've got a pyramidal structure in place at the moment, which means leaders are on top, disseminating information down a line of management, basically. And I always try and do things so that it's a point of service, that the person that's organizing is actually the lowest point, so is only ever needed if it's necessary, so people are inspired to take control and be in charge when they are applicable to the situation that comes up. So, and that's the way I feel community works in its best sense.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. I'm developing myself a bit of detail on leadership, and have realised that the word itself is a bit misleading. There's a word in Welsh which is brongor, which means way shower, which might be more applicable.
Certainly that, though I wouldn't even take that on as a role. My role that I play is to hold the space, because that is my particular thing that I'm good at. I know I'm able and have the ability to organise a space and get the infrastructure there, and then to actually hold it energetically. So that's my talent. That doesn't mean that I can way show in other ways. It means that I know I can do that.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I'm thinking is that basically, as different things arise, different skills are needed, and so different people, your idea is, isn't it, is to get different people to rise to the point of way show for the point where they're needed.
Everyone, if we want to go back to the old word leader, everybody is one in their own particular area, and it's about people discovering that within themselves. So it's an empowerment process, and for that there's a lot of personal work. So community starts really from the individual, the I, and community is based, for me at least, around the way that we can become what we're supposed to be, each as an individual, and how that meshes in. So again, I go back to this, how we interface with our family, because that's another I. It's just zooming out one digit, if you like, and then how we interface with the community. And it's all, there's always people that may wind you up, may make you angry. There's lots of emotions that come up when we're interacting with others, and there's different ways. Non-violent communication is one of them, or compassionate communication, in which we can try and get through the first layers of reaction, the sort of blaming and judging each other or ourselves. And instead of doing that, we can kind of get into these underlayers of feeling and need and requests. And that can be done in a much more gentle way, where it's coming from a point that is not as intellectual as the one we're taught through our schooling system to reside in. And it's a bit of a peculiar place to get to. There's an authenticity and very much a vulnerability that comes with it. And it can be incredibly uncomfortable if you're not used to being in that space when you first encounter it. But once you've been there for a little while, you realize that vulnerability is the strongest position you can be in rather than the weakest, and open yourself up to others. Actually, if you need something from your community and you can talk from your heart space, then more often than not, you'll get it. If you talk from a point of anger, then you're going to alienate the people around you. Or if you're always in a space of poor me, you're going to alienate people from you. And so I guess it's about being authentic. And there's a difference between making a request of someone and making a demand. So there's no emotional response if it's been a request. You're not pissed off that the person can't fulfill it. But a demand, there always is. So a lot of the time we hide, and I do this myself. I will freely admit that I'm not anywhere near perfect. I will hide my demands as requests. And there's also this thing about capacity, our capacity to be able to meet other people's requests and what happens within us when we're not able to do that. And I had an experience a few weeks ago in an empathy session where I realized that I was in a situation where I'd just bought a new car, and the people I bought it from had sold me a bit of a duffer, basically. And I realized that I actually felt guilt and shame in asking and requesting from them to give me a proper service. But this was hidden behind anger. And it wasn't until I got through this first layer and realized that I started to realize, after a bit of reflection, I talked to my partner, Mandy, and she said that she felt the same at times. And then we introduced this to the group, and they felt the same. And I realized that it's kind of systemic. And then I realized that I do this to my children, and my mother and father did it to me, so that when they didn't have the capacity to meet my request, they'd become angry, or they'd start with the poor me, or, you know, something else. And it's kind of like a karmic cycle, where we're passing this on. We don't have the capacity or the language, the means, in order to be able to explain why we can't meet the request, or why we haven't got the time at that particular point. So it's just this kind of rush of energy that is a regurgitation, if you like, a pushing away, which comes out as anger, sadness, or something else.
So in many ways, we are actually living out the patterns that we learn in the home and then take them out to the rest of the world.
Well, for me, the patterns, and this is where the self-blame comes into it. The patterns are all learned. They're not really us in our purest form. They're kind of everything that, when we were soaking things up like a sponge when we were very young, that has been said to us. So a lot of the reinforcements that we're actually giving to ourselves and the way we chastise ourselves is actually what our parents or our teachers or some person that we saw as an authority figure. And this still happens within our society because it's so hierarchical. So if a boss chastises us, we take that on, and that becomes self-language as well. And it's about trying to move backwards, back through those, and kind of realize, bring them to consciousness, so that we can grieve the situation, we can be sad about it without beating ourselves up or beating someone else up. And I don't mean that in a physical sense, obviously. Language, why is it appears to be Anglo-Saxon to me at this point, appears to be quite violent. There's a lot of shoulds, musts, have-tos that we express to others and to ourselves. There's so much obligation within our language to do something, and we take it on quite readily. So there's a thing about boundaries. So there is important to have boundaries between these different selves so that we know what's ours and what's another's. So if someone's trying to push something upon us, we don't have to take it. We see it as a request. And there's something about, in non-violent communication, that it doesn't matter what the communication is. It's either a please or a thank you. So it doesn't matter how it comes over, whether it's screamed in your face. It's just a really badly made request. It's a plea for you to help, or it might be a thank you. So it's just kind of switching that mindset, and really that involves a lot of introspection and a lot of looking at why we react. And after we've got through a little bit, we can go and hunt out people that actually really piss us off in order to test ourselves a little bit, you know. And that's the interesting thing about putting events on. You can never guarantee who's going to arrive. You can hold space. There's always going to be something that goes on and has to be dealt with, and that is really what makes life interesting.
And in a way, we have to realise, don't we, that just like we're free people, so is everybody else. And if people are interacting with each other in, shall we say, a noisy fashion, then it's their way of doing it, and it doesn't need to involve us.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. There is a part of me that always, I don't like to interfere. If I feel somebody is kind of asking me a question, then I will share maybe how I feel the interaction could have been different. I don't mind I love banter. Let's not get me wrong. When I'm, you know, building stuff with the guys, you know, we're taking the mickey out of each other. We're just like a normal bunch of blokes. But there are situations that call for a different mindset. When people are triggered and you can see that they haven't got the capacity to deal at that particular point with the emotion that's coming up in them, and it's really rising and raging, or it's really sad and deep and, you know, heart. And they're the points when these introspections and these techniques really come into their fore and can help through the situation. And they're not perfect. They're not going to solve every single one. Not everybody's ready. And that's fine too. So
I mean, obviously you started learning this stuff by recognizing kind of habitual patterns in the family, and I know that you've got quite an extensive history of helping to organize raves during the dance years. What sort of stuff are you putting together in response to these realizations now for the 21st century?
Well, as I say, there are events that I organize, one being a little gathering called Heart of the East that we do each year, which is on the parameters that I've already described. Essentially, I've done many raves in my time, and many organisations of festivals. There was a recognition in me that when you've got crew and punter, there's always a divide created. So we took that out of the equation straight away. Everybody pays a donation. It's always only to cover the costs. There was a recognition in me because I put so much energy into it that the money is not really an issue. What you put in really truly is what you get out. And so the amount of fulfillment I get from being that point of service is truly beyond words. I couldn't really express it.
I think personally that you're doing people a real favour there, because it took me 15 years of going to festivals before, as a punter, before I realised that the way to thoroughly enjoy a festival is to become part of the crew, to actually have a base to work from, and to be part of making the thing that people are enjoying happen. And what you're effectively doing is giving everybody the opportunity to make that realisation. How do you, you've been doing the Heart of the East couple of years now. How did it go in the first year, and was it any better this year?
Last year was an incredible experience, but what was found was that as more people were gathering on the Friday of the event, which is, we run it for 3 days, Friday, Saturday and Sunday, but basically we start the event from the Sunday before in the setup, and everybody's welcome to turn up. But as more people turn up because they can't make the commitment through work or whatever, or they just haven't got the space in their lives, you obviously get different people coming in and not all understand the ethos. So in the first year there was a lot of littering, and I'm talking on the physical, the psychic and the emotional levels, people just releasing, and that had to be kind of dealt with on the Saturday morning, and then the thing just was absolutely amazing from that point onwards. This year the people that came were just in a different space. It was just remarkable. The energy was just so gentle and nurturing. There was no need to prompt anybody to behave in any particular way because everybody was totally on song. It was an incredible event. There were a few technical issues with the way the food was prepped that will be kind of put right for next year. But there was no real obvious. I've had no feedback that's negative, essentially. None at all, which was remarkable.
That's excellent, that is, isn't it? I mean, the catering always is difficult, I think, at new events. It takes a while to find out what it is that people need. It also can be difficult to get people with experience because most people who've done the catering go, oh, I'm not going to do that again. So you're obviously having everybody paying the same amount, so you're getting rid of the divide between the crew and the punter. I think it's a great idea because what I like to say is, look, if nobody's dropping the litter, nobody has to miss the festival picking it all up again. And I like to say that applies not just to the litter, that applies across the board. So like you say, with the emotional stuff as well. How did you deal with the kind of emotional problem or the emotional challenges? Effectively, it's people bringing the family stuff that you're describing, this sort of habitual output, to a festival and dumping emotional garbage on people randomly. How did you deal with that in the first year?
Well, there was an element of space clearing on a shamanic level that came into play. But in general, it was just to let people know that they were in a sanctified space and they didn't have to. But it would be a good choice if they could be mindful of the way they were acting. But there is a certain element that there's a realization that when a space is created that is of a very high vibration, that there will be a certain element that will just dump because they have stuff that requires dumping to raise to that vibration. So that has to be taken care of. There has to be people there that do that kind of stuff. But in general, everybody is capable of dealing with that. And actually looking after that part of themselves if they want to. There was one lady there this year that was quite deeply, I don't know the best word to describe it, I guess damaged is the best way, when she came last year. And she was back this year and you know, she left on the Saturday. I just don't think she could maintain herself in the space, which was really sad and unfortunate. But I'm sure she'll be back next year because she had a good time up to that point.
So here we're doing what we normally do, except that instead of having a couple of spaces this year full of speakers and activities, we've got four. And obviously there's bands and all that kind of stuff going on here. What kind of things do you get up to at the Heart of the East?
Well, at Heart of the East, we don't have any bands on, we don't have any speakers. We have community sessions, which are based around discussion groups, some gaming, using Experience the Game, which is something that kind of brings in it's almost like using tarot, but on a group level, where people come in with intentions and pick a life card out of that, which reflects upon the intention, and then you kind of make groups out of that, which start to form something from each other's intentions and cards. It's an excellent way of breaking the ice, but it's also an excellent way of bringing in another dimension, which people can, you know, become more aware of, and teasing stuff out of people. It's just really getting people to release. But we entertain ourselves, so there was an incredible amount of brilliant musicians there this year. We'd have a Saturday night knees up, where, I mean, we had a thunderstorm this year in the middle of it, and John Witterick doing the headbutt song just as the clap of thunder came in, which was actually hilarious. We had an amazingly talented lady that was a beatboxer. We had really talented guitarists and musicians. Sunday night was fantastic because we just had a jamming session, impromptu jamming session, with everyone just coming in and doing all sorts of nasal singing and drumming and all the rest of it. So there's kind of two parts to it. There's kind of the nitty-gritty discussions of how how people want to move the thing forward, and then there's the people really enjoying each other's company and getting to know one another. And for me, this is where it's a reflection of this kind of indigenous cultures, which... So there's this thing that happened in the 15th, 16th century, where we had this renaissance. And it was almost like we went out to the Middle East and brought information back. But that was, again, from a high culture. And what seems to be happening now is a second renaissance. But this time we're actually bringing back information from the indigenous cultures, and we're reintegrating that, the tribal stuff. And so they would have their powwows. They would sit down. They would... you know, thrash out the nitty-gritty. They'd use a lot of techniques, like the speaking into the candle, only ever saying I, owning that the information. But then they'd have tribal dances around the fire. You know, they'd have proper community-spirited dances where they came together and enjoyed each other's company. And this is really what we're trying to reflect. I think this is something that, for me anyway, I've found I'm lacking it, which is why I like to organise gatherings, which... bring and integrate these things in, you know.
I love it when people entertain themselves. It's happened to me several times. We do a bit of it at Old Chapel Farm where we were. We did it on a course I went to down at the Schumacher College, where every Thursday we did a cabaret. And the first one was good. It lasted about an hour and a half. The next week it lasted 2.5 hours. And the week after that, 3-4 hours, this group of 36 people, epic Scottish poetry, stand-up comedy, song, and no technology. No technology at all. I think it's a great thing. And it seems to me that people are ready to start sharing community when they're given the correct kind of setting. What do you think, you know, because we've got Natasha's just arrived, so we'll be able to release you back to your crew duties. What do you think you're going to be doing next year at the Heart of the East that will be different from this year?
I don't know that it needs to be changed radically. There will be a few bits of tinkering. What I'd like to see happen more and more is that there's a lot more support at the beginning and the end in putting the infrastructure in. So there are many people that just come in for the actual main part, if you like. But for me, if you really want to get something out of something, you come from the beginning and you leave at the end, and you're there for everything. And I think for me, if the community can come together next year in that style, something even more impressive will happen.
Well, I'll be there with you from the beginning next time, because it's what we do, isn't it? We arrive a good few days earlier, and here we had the unfortunate job. We've been building stuff, folks, here for 3 years, and somebody came in a week or so ago and burnt the whole lot, covered most of the site we're using in broken glass and all manner of other stuff. We are still picking it out of the grass today. But I'll be there on the construction phase next time, and I'll be there for the gig. I'm really looking forward to it. Rick Fields is saying, fascinating guy this, so 10 out of 10 to you. But in closing, I'd like to ask you how you respond to the captain's question, which is, where do you get all these old hippies from, Doc?
Well, I was dug up from Luton. I grew up in a very normal family. I don't describe myself as a hippie. You know, we were pretty radical when I was younger. We were squatting. We were putting on rave parties. For me, what I do now is an extension of that. I don't need to bust into a warehouse anymore, and I don't need to fuck off police officers, you know, which we did. We really experienced people power. We got rid of, we faced up to 1,000 riot police, you know, with 5,000 people. I don't need to do that anymore, though, only if necessary, you know. That was my youth, and now I'm growing into my adulthood and trying to discover myself. So I might sound like an old hippie. I don't mind that title, you know. Why would I? Thank you, Captain, is all I can say.
Well, thank you very much for coming and joining us, Nan. And I always say, if somebody asks me if I'm a hippie, I'll ask them if they're looking for a punch in the throat. So I'm going to put on another couple of tunes whilst we get Natasha settled in to talk to us, hopefully, about shamanic journeying, which is one of my favourite subjects. I've not got a lot of experience of it, but the stuff I've done I've really enjoyed. So we've got 10 minutes of music or so whilst we chill together. Hope you're doing that out there. And this is Free Me from Roger Daltrey. That was Bristol Afrobeat Project, who I saw earlier on this year at Fire in the Mountain, just one huge horn section, and they were playing a tune called How He Get a Life, and this is Dr. Rock's radio show on peoplesinternetradio.com. We're coming to you live from the Green Gathering and trying to give you a bit of a sample of some of the people that will be speaking here and doing workshops over the next two or three days. And I've now been joined by Natasha. So, Natasha, what are you going to be doing for us this weekend?
Hi, everybody. We're going to be doing three workshops. One is shamanic rattle making with wild deer skins that have been shot locally to me where I live and prepared shamanically with the permission of the animal, of the spirit of the deer, to make them into rattles. So I'm going to be facilitating a workshop for everybody to make their own rattle and journey to the spirit of the deer and ask what the rattle is being birthed for. What is it? What is its purpose and how is it to be used? We're also doing two shamanic workshops. One is an introduction into shamanism, so demystifying it, basically. We hear all these terms these days about what shamans are, what they do, and my experience is that people get really confused by it and hand their power over to the so-said shaman. And actually, what I'm really passionate about is teaching people to, just demystifying it, showing them what the terms are and saying, look, you can do this for yourself. And here's the tools, here's how you do it safely, and let's do the first few together.
My experience of it is that people take to it really naturally when they have it explained to them in clear and simple terms. How would you basically describe a shaman to somebody who hasn't come across it before?
Firstly, I would say that a shaman, the true definition of the word shaman is somebody who sees in the dark and talks with spirit. So in indigenous cultures, the shaman is the medicine person who journeys for the community to spirit to gain answers for questions, and is a healer as well. So they're a conduit for spirit, as I call it, a hollow bone. So they become hollow and journey to spirit, ask the questions, and then bring the answers back for their community. But in modern society here in the UK, if anybody calls themselves a shaman, I think you should all question, really? Who are you? What are you doing? Because I don't think anybody can actually use that term in the Western world. It's something that's bestowed on somebody at a very young age in an indigenous culture, and it's a role that they play their whole lives. And our culture is not set up to do that. So it's always a red flag in my world if somebody says, I'm a shaman. I work shamanically, but I'm not a shaman.
Yeah, the words are really important, aren't they? And I know that the people who I regard as true practitioners, they don't call themselves shamans either. Other people call them shamans. But I guess that's partly, isn't it? Because we here in the West are encouraged to believe that we are anchored in the physical world and that there is no spiritual world or spirit world. Whereas the shaman, as far as I can see it, is a walker between worlds, isn't he? A kind of communicator. So what kind of healing work do they do and how do they set about it?
In order to answer that question, I guess you have to understand just the basics or the fundamentals around the shamanic worldview, really. And it doesn't matter what culture you're in, the core principles of a shamanic view are the consistent through all. So indigenous cultures around the world will believe that this plane or this planet that we're on, so the mundane life, is what I would term as the middle world. And then there's the lower world, which is the realms of nature and nature spirit. And then there's the upper world, which are the realms of the gods, really. And there's an axis mundi that the shaman will traverse between those. Now, it's written into our mythology and our stories as children about axis mundi. So Jack and the Beanstalk, for example, he planted the bean and the bean grew and he travelled up the bean to the upper world to see the gods. So it's in our story, but we're disconnected from that. So a shaman will traverse those worlds to on quests, so to bring healing, personal healing for people, or to find information out, assist in hunting, for example, and stuff like that for the community. So we can work shamanically to find questions and communicate directly with spirit without actually having to go through somebody else. So it's, for me, it's about empowering people to learn how to do it so that we all can do it for ourselves. And then shamanic healing is using the same techniques, but it's about journeying to spirit to find out where a person is not whole and what needs to happen for that. So to retrieve power or soul loss, to retrieve pits of people's spirit and bring it back, to make sure that the person's whole and in their power.
So, because I hear that when people are kind of abused as children and stuff, they tend to hide bits of themselves away inside and forget they exist. Is that the kind of thing that can be helped with this sort of practice?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what I would term as soul loss. So if you imagine that we are a vessel or an egg, and when we're in our power, then that egg is full. And we feel really strong in ourselves and certain. And then things come along in life that shock us or hurt us. And bits of ourselves shoot off to protect ourselves. And in modern society, we often call that disassociation. So if, for example, in the same example that you used, if somebody is abused, often what they'll talk about is feeling numb, I wasn't really there, I just shut down, it was like I just went blank, I don't remember what happened. And what happens is that part of our spirit goes to somewhere safe, because that's what we need to feel, is feel safe at that point in time. So it goes to somewhere in the spirit world to be safe. And what a shamanic healer will do is journey in the other worlds to find that bit of your spirit and bring it back and make you whole again, in simplistic terms. Another example is you could have a shock. So we've all had that example where we've set an alarm clock, unfortunately, early in the morning, and we've been in a really deep sleep and it's gone off and we feel really confused. And we don't know, we're fumbling around in the dark. And part of it is because we're asleep, but part of it is, you know, we were shocked when we were asleep. And so temporarily, a bit of our spirit has shot off somewhere because of the shock. Naturally, you know, normally over the course of the next few hours, it will naturally come back and we'll feel more focused. But it's exactly the same thing that happens for different reasons.
Yeah, I've heard that that happens when people have things like car accidents as well, that they quite often don't remember what happened just before. They can lose several minutes and stuff. Yeah. And really, I guess the alarm clock thing's like a baby version of that, isn't it?
Yeah, completely. It's exactly the same thing. And I think, you know, we can all look back over our lives and think of situations like that. And if those bits of our spirit aren't retrieved, then what happens is the egg has a hole in it. So as we're going through our lives, energy that's, it's not that it's bad energy or wrong energy, it's just that it's the wrong energy in the wrong place at the wrong time. So it's a bit like the spider in the bath. The spider's not bad, it's just you don't want it really in your bath. So what happens is if you have a hole, then unwanted things can step in, which then can cause disease. Or dis-ease, as in illnesses. And one of the things that a shamanic practitioner will do is also extraction work to remove that energy that doesn't belong to you, and then go and gain your power back, because the hole's there because of soul loss or power loss. And, you know, often people that, so for example, a good example of an intrusion, what we would call an intrusion, is if all of a sudden you know, you're not feeling, you know, you're not feeling quite yourself, and maybe you walk into a party and you know that that moment when you walk into a room and you just feel that maybe something's a bit amiss. Yeah. Like maybe somebody's had an argument or whatever, you feel the energy. Well, if you've got soul loss or power loss, something can, that energy can jump into you and it can manifest as really sudden illnesses. So, for example, sharp pains in the shoulder or something like that. It's a clear indication often of an intrusion, and then it's removing that.
That's funny. I used to get those a lot. I used to get really stabbing pains in the backside, in the backside of my body somewhere. They could be in the legs or in the back, and they'd literally rip all my breath out of me and throw me to the floor like something had actually grabbed me. It used to really shock people around me. It shocked me quite a lot as well. I mean, I guess the kind of soul retrieval and the fixing work is really complex stuff, and you'd need a fair degree of experience to do that. But we can all be taught to do the travelling, can't we?
Oh, completely. I mean, everybody can do it. And it's something when often when I teach people to do it, it's like second nature for them. It's like, oh, I kind of know how to do this already. Or, you know what, as a child, I remember doing this. I used to, if I was upset or at night, at, you know, certain times, I would go off journeying out my window into the woods and meet these spirits and stuff. And often people recall it from their childhood before we were programmed to forget those things.
It's really common in children. In fact, I gather that up till the age of 7, they're more or less living in that kind of state.
Yeah, often if their parents encourage them.
Yeah.
I think sometimes it can be banged out of children at a really young age. My niece grew up when she was about 3 or 4, and she used to walk up and down the garden talking to all the plants. And she'd start at one end and work her way up the border and talk to all the plant spirits and then down the other end. Now, I encouraged her. Unfortunately, my brother and his wife are not really living my reality. And she very quickly stopped doing it as a result of their reaction.
Do you think also there's any connection between the shamanic travelling and what we do when we're dreaming?
Yeah, I mean, as the Aboriginals call it, the dream time, really. I think there's two types of dreams. I think there's just normal processing dreams that go on because of stresses of life and so forth. But I know for me that true visionary dreams and journeying dreams have a different feel about them. And I just instinctively know when they're different and I'm communicating with spirit. And of course, we can learn to journey when we dream as well, because that is a gateway through, and through discipline. Now, I'm not brilliant at this, so I'm not the best person to talk to, and through discipline it can be learnt as a way of journeying, definitely.
Yeah, we have had people on the show talking before about lucid dreaming, and it's something that I know Synchro does a lot of. And every now and then I have one as well. Mostly, though, I go, "What? This is a lucid dream," and I wake up. So what's the what would the shaman use the rattle for that we're going to be building this weekend?
Well, I use the rattle for clearing energy. So it's really great at agitating energy. So if I'm doing a healing for somebody, I will rattle over them and then settle the energy field down afterwards as well. It's really great for clearing energy in stuck places as well, and shifting it around so that it can be released and moved on. And what's amazing about the rattles is that, you know, if you make your own, you have the choice what to put in it, what wood to use, what skin to use, and actually what to put in it to make it rattle. So you can call in different energies for different types of work by picking things specifically.
Yeah. And you mentioned the deer skin and it being, I know that a lot of indigenous cultures regard hunting as more of a dance, that the creature, when it's done properly, the creature that's being killed is actually sacrificing itself, and that there's some kind of understanding going on with the hunter. Can you maybe explain that a bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I've been really privileged to host some Indigenous elders from the depths of the Amazon, from various tribes, Mapuche and so forth, all the way up to Guatemala and Venezuela. And in the case of the elders that I hosted, they were all men, and they were true shamans for the community. And one of the things that they do for their community is they journey before the hunt. So they journey out onto the plains and talk to the spirit of the animals in the rainforest and say, we're coming to hunt, we need to eat. Please, is one of you, and they petition the spirit, you know, is there one, the spirit of an animal out there that is willing to sacrifice themselves? And they never go out hunting without the shaman doing that. And then the shaman goes with them. And some of the stories that they talk about of the kills is remarkable. You know, that literally an animal that would normally be really skittish, you know, skittish and so forth, will come. And it's almost like they present themselves to be killed, and they do it humanely. And then the shaman will sing or journey the spirit of the animal over. They'll bless it, and then they will honour it in the preparation and use every part of it as much as possible.
So they're doing the work as much for the deer as they are for the humans, which I think is really great. So do you know much about the deer that was hunted for the skin that are being used this weekend?
Yeah, I live in Wiltshire, beautiful Wiltshire, and we have some local butchers to us in the local market who basically hunt their own game for their game stall on the market. So they're all shot by Martin and his friend Paul, and they use every part of the animal. And they were so happy when I went to them and talked to them about the skins, because that was the only part of the animal that they didn't use. and they were like, finally, now we're using, you know, nose to tail, and that's what we want to do. So they feel that it's the right thing to do. And then when the skins come to me, we prepare them within a ritual space. It's quite a long process to prepare the skins to make rawhide, and then from that we make the drums and the rattles, and we journey to the spirit of the deer asking permission. Now, if the deer didn't want its skin to be used, I wouldn't use it. That, you know, that has to be said. It's really important to have permission for that to happen and for it to be done with spirit.
Do you know what they use the rest of the bits of the deer for?
Well, yeah, they eat it. They sell it. They make the most amazing gluten-free sausages for my partner. And also their friend has a wolf pack. So they...
Their friend has a wolf pack?
Yes, it does. So the skulls go to the wolves. And the antlers, walking sticks are made from those, and the feet go to the wolves as well to feed the wolves.
Wow, where does he keep the wolves?
Somewhere in Wiltshire.
Well, there you go, folks. There's wolves out in Wiltshire. Well, I think that's absolutely fabulous. Thank you. I'm really looking forward to coming to a shamanic journey in class, and I'd like to reassess whether I can actually come and make my own shamanic rattle as well. That'd be great. But thank you very, very much for joining us, Natasha. I really appreciate it.
It's been brilliant. Thank you.
That's great. So I'm going to... Yes, you may stand down. Thank you very much. I'll put on another tune, and then we can have a word with the fabulous Fred Gillam. It'd be brilliant. So here we go. Hang on, I haven't got the right screen up. Sorry about the rattling on the mic. We're using it as a talking stick. Here we go. Here comes Sheena McGuigan, Lost in Transylvania. That was Sheena McGuigan, Lost in Transylvania, another band seen and danced to at Fire in the Mountain earlier this year. Thanks to Natasha for giving us a brief overview of shamanic healing and shamanic travelling there, and what happens to deers, and the fact that there's wolves in Wiltshire. They learn something new every day. Well, next up in Mr. Electric's bus is Fred Gillam. Some of you may remember he was on the show about a year ago when Synchro recorded an interview for us with him talking about the Ogham tree alphabet. Well, today we're going to be talking a little bit about food foraging and plant spirit medicine. So thanks, Fred. Welcome to the Dr. Rock radio show. And I gather you've just been on a forage. What have you managed to find for yourself in the fields around Chepstow?
all kinds of wonderful things, actually. We found a very nice specimen of chicken of the woods just growing from one of the ancient oak trees up here. That was really exciting. We thought there would be some because up here above Chepstow Racecourse there are lovely old oak woodlands, and it was just very small, but smelled absolutely gorgeous, really, really got the digestive juices going. And I was able to talk about the life cycle of fungi and how they inhabit trees for their entire lifetime, which is something I think not many people knew about.
Perhaps you could give us a quick summary here, because I don't know how mushrooms inhabit trees or what their relationship with them is, actually.
Okay, well, the relationship of mushrooms with trees is actually a fairly complex one. But the bracket fungi, now, by bracket fungi, I'm talking about the mushrooms that grow as if they were shelves coming out of tree trunks that you'll sometimes see. Very often, the mycelium, which is the thread-like material that travels through the bark and through the wood of the tree, the true body of the fungal organism, has been with the tree for its entire lifespan. And sometimes it will get in by means of spores blowing in the wind or introduced by animals or whatever and get into a wound in the tree. But very often, it actually colonizes the tree at the seed stage when it's germinating and grows with it for its entire life, and only much later on begins to produce fruit bodies when it's ready to reproduce, often when the tree itself is becoming quite old and decrepit.
So the mushroom kind of lurks in there and waits for its chance. It sort of can, and that, I mean, with the case of an oak tree, that could be 1,000 years, couldn't it?
Yes, it could, certainly a few hundred years at the very least. Maybe I liken it to the fact that we all, in human bodies, we have lots of bacteria and lots of fungi that dwell within us all of the time. And one day, you know, heaven forbid, when we pop our clogs and fall over, these organisms will start to break us down and return us to the earth. They will literally compost us and break the big molecules down into smaller ones and return us to the earth. And really the fungi, that's one of the roles that the fungal kingdom plays in nature, is it's part of the great cycle of decay. It's the flip side to growth, if you like. It's about breaking things down and returning them to raw materials that can be reused.
I'd love to have seen the chicken of the woods, because we're now up to, I think, 12 or 13 wild mushrooms safely eaten, and I haven't encountered a chicken of the woods yet. What else did you find in your walk?
From the fungi kingdom, we also found a really nice specimen of a weeping bracket, which is very, very beautiful. It's covered in amber droplets, and later on they often become a bit darker and look like drops of blood, so it's often called the weeping bracket. And that has a completely different smell. It doesn't smell sort of mushroomy and tasty at all. It actually smells a bit like decaying fruit. But it's a most peculiar-looking thing, also very often on old oak trees. And we talked about lots and lots of common plants, things ranging from stinging nettles and dandelions to sorrel and lime trees and all sorts of things, but explored a lot of the uses that indigenous peoples have put these things to, and often they're quite surprising uses too.
So what's the most surprising use that something you found today has been put to, do you reckon?
Well, I waxed lyrical for quite a long time about stinging nettles. No foraging walk is ever complete without stinging nettles, and you know, the minute you start talking about stinging nettles, people, I think, immediately think about boiling up Boy Scouts and dib, dib, dib and dob, dob, dob and making nettle soup. But there's so much more to them. For example, currently the roots of stinging nettles are undergoing trials in North America as a medicine for enlargement of the prostate and prostate cancer. And it turns out that in these trials so far, it appears that nettle roots have the ability to inhibit quite a few strains of prostate cancer without being toxic to healthy cells. So that's one of the things we talked about. And we talked about the use of nettle seed, which is actually quite a metabolic stimulant and a food for the adrenal glands, which produce adrenaline as a reaction to stress. And very often people who are chronically stressed, and, you know, particularly in the world that we live in, where people are doing hideous office jobs and going home and then just getting up and going in straight onto the treadmill again, the adrenal glands can get a bit burned out, and instead of an appropriate adrenaline response, our bloodstream starts to be filled with cortisols, which are stress hormones. Now, everywhere cortisols land in the body, pretty much they produce an inflammatory response and tend to trigger disease reactions. But nettle seed is actually given by medical herbalists as a tonic food for the adrenal glands to support the action of the adrenal glands and keep them healthy. And it's also rather nice to eat. It's really nutty and oily, slightly bitter, but you should only eat it in small amounts because it is actually a bit overstimulating if you overdo it. So, you know, a teaspoonful on top of some seedy bread is a good thing, but not too much.
I know, that's where it came from, because I know that Synchro, also known as Jess, when it must have been after encountering you, she started wildly collecting nettle seeds when we were staying at Bodnam Manor, where there were loads of nettles. She actually harvested a whole gallon of them, so we were eating them for a couple of years.
Wow.
She was pretty determined, and she did it with bare hands as well, because she reckons that there's some benefits to being stung by nettles as well. Is that the case?
That's absolutely true. There's plenty of anecdotal evidence. I'm not sure about scientific studies, but there are lots and lots of people out there who suffer with things like arthritic joints and rheumatism who get a lot of relief from stinging themselves with nettles. And if we look at ancient historical texts, we hear about Roman legionaries, things that were written down by Roman generals and the like about the habits of marching soldiers, and that they used to flagellate themselves with bunches of stinging nettles. People, I think, always assumed that it was some sort of either peculiar ritual practice or that it was, they were just a bunch of old pervs, really. But the truth of the matter is, actually, you get a great deal of pain relief. And one theory that supports this is that in the skin we have nerve synapses that either register touch or synapses that register pain. And one of the first things we instinctually do if we hurt ourselves is to rub the area. And if you think of a small child, for example, falls over and grazes his knee or whatever, the first thing, you rub it better. Okay? Now, when the nervous response to touch is received by the brain, it is actually blocking out the signal of pain from the synapses registering pain. So when we sting ourselves with a bunch of nettles around, say, a sore joint or something like that, what happens is you maybe get 20 minutes of intentional pain, and it will hurt, obviously, and that's the whole point, it has to. And after that, the nettle venom has been injected into the skin, and it starts to stimulate the touch receptors. And you know, anyone listening to this, you probably recognise the familiar creeping sensation in the skin sometime after you've been stung with stinging nettles. And that, if you do it well, it might last for up to 72 hours. Now, all the while you're receiving that creeping, crawling skin sensation, which is actually not too bad once you get to know it, it's blocking a lot of the pain receptors and really, really dulling the pain response. But it's also telling the brain that you're less injured, so therefore it's sending less inflammatory markers to the area and reducing the inflammation as well.
That's absolutely fabulous, isn't it? I've often heard it said that all of the plants that are really common, and of course nettles are, have loads and loads of uses. So like alder's another one that we see all around us. Is that a useful plant too?
The good old elder tree is a stunningly useful plant. It's like having a pharmacy right next to your back door if you've got one growing there. Every part of the elder tree is used for something, although nowadays we wouldn't tend to use the elder root very much as a poison because we don't have much call for it. But it sort of falls into the category of poisons that once upon a time would have brought down empires, you know, and been put in people's cups. It's deadly stuff. Don't mess with elder roots. The bark, though, does yield a useful oil, which brings out bruising. It brings bruising out and resolves it. You know, it works a treat, a bit like in the same way that people use arnica tincture or ointments made from arnica. The young buds of leaf buds in the spring can actually be pickled, and in the bud stage they're edible and quite nice. The leaves, although this has fallen out of use quite a lot in the modern era, are what we call an emetic, so they bring about vomiting. And if somebody had swallowed poison once upon a time, they would be fed the leaves one by one, and at a certain point everyone's tolerance is different. They would projectile vomit the contents of their stomach, so it was an old-fashioned way of pumping the stomach, really. Now, moving on to the flowers, which I'm sure a lot of people will have tried elderflower cordial, which is now very, very popular. Its resurgence of its popularity is a lovely thing to see. And in fact, there are elder orchards now in Herefordshire being grown just to produce the elderflowers for bottle green cordial, apparently, which is fantastic. But the elderflowers are very medicinal in a mild and gentle way. They're lightly astringent, so they'll help with mild diarrhoea. And they are also what we call a diaphoretic, so they open the surface of the body, the skin, and help people to sweat out toxins. And if you're going down with the flu or a cold or something like that, drinking elderflower tea along with something to heat your body up, maybe chili pepper or ginger or something like that, will help you to sweat it out and get on top of it. And then we go on to the berries. And the berries, of course, are delicious. And in fact, most blackberry jams that you buy in the shops are actually have a high percentage of elderberries in them. And they're brought in from Eastern Europe, where they're produced in abundance. But the berries are really special because there are flavonoids in the berries. And flavonoids are a group of compounds, a special group of compounds that exist in the plant kingdom. But in the case of the elder, the actual flavonoids in the elder will break down the protein coating on flu virus particles. Okay, so there's a product, I won't give its name out on the air because I think that's probably a bit unfair, but there's a product that you can buy in Boots the Chemist, which is basically an elderberry syrup. And it was clinically trialled in Greece and shown to be very, very effective. But you can actually just make your own elderberry syrup. It's a traditional old remedy for the flu. Literally, you pick as many elderberries as you can get hold of, carefully take off the green parts, the stems. And the best way to do that is to use a kitchen fork and just pull the stems through a kitchen fork so all the berries pop off. And once you've got them in a pan, over a low heat for about half an hour, just reduce them down. And the volume will reduce down till there's about a quarter of what you started with. And at that point, whatever volume you've got left, just add half as much sugar or honey. Again, stir it in, make sure it's dissolved well, and just bottle it. Now, this elderberry syrup is every bit as good as something you would buy in the shops. And if you're going down with the flu on that first day when you feel a bit dizzy, if you just take 2 tablespoons full every 2 hours and keep dosing with it, what happens is every time the flu virus replicates itself and breaks out of your cells, damaging the cells, the proteins on the surface of the flu virus that it uses to stick to your cells are actually destroyed by the flavonoids in your bloodstream. So it's magic stuff for the flu, you know, really great. And I always have a big supply in stock in the winter for all my friends and family.
Absolutely fabulous, that is. Thank you. We've got a couple of questions have arisen in the chat box here. Rick's saying, he's saying he's loving your talk. And he'd like to know if there's any particular use that Angelica might be put to.
Angelica's is a very powerful medicine, actually. In European folklore, it's the herb that is sacred to the Archangel Michael. And if you think of the symbolism around the Archangel Michael, he was later on considered to be a dragon slayer, but in the early days was really very much not a dragon slayer, but somebody who tamed the dragon. So in early medieval iconography, he was pictured walking with the dragon on a leash or something like this and not killing the dragon. And I think that's quite interesting because it's about the dragon can be a symbol of life force and vital energy in nature. And I think the Angelica plant is absolutely imbued with it. It's got a very, very powerful life force. And it's particularly good at expelling nasty things. Okay, so it's a great antiviral agent. It's an antimicrobial agent. It's also in its own right quite hot, quite a hot herb. Quite an acrid herb, so it heats the system up. It's got loads and loads of uses, actually.
And also, what else have we got here? Rick's also said that he found some Lady of the Forest fungus last week. And you know about that one?
I'm awfully sorry, but I don't really know what Lady of the Forest is. Can that person elaborate?
We will see. We'll just keep an eye on that. I mean, obviously, these are great. I think that the elderberry medicine is going to work a lot better if you make it yourself than it is if you buy it from the shop, in all likelihood, because it's got a lot of your intent in it. Is that correct?
Well, in my book, that's certainly correct. I don't think there's any kind of scientific way to back that up. But if you look at the spiritual practices of indigenous peoples and their cultures and the way that they work with plants, it's very, very important to have a personal relationship with the plants that you work with. And in my experience, all of the really, really sharp, almost miraculous cures that seem to happen with herbs really revolve around having a great connection with the plants. If you look at some of the South American cultures that work with plants as entheogens and as curatives, very often they will cultivate a particular tree or a particular vine, and it will remain in the family of the shaman, and they will tend that one tree. So it wouldn't be good enough to go and harvest any particular plant of that species. It is actually from the tree that they have a very personal relationship with, and they tend it on a regular basis, look after it, speak to it, relate to it on a day-by-day basis.
So this presumably takes us into one of the subjects that you're here to talk about, which is plant spirit medicine, which sounds really magical. What's the is this an indigenous thing, or is it, did it ever exist here?
God, you're really giving me some tough questions now. Did it ever exist here? In my opinion, very definitely yes. And I don't know if anyone listening has read a book by, I think it's Brian Bates, called The Way of the Weird, which came out some years ago, which is actually a fictional book, but it takes a lot of material, I think, from the Lacnunga manuscript, which is a book of Anglo-Saxon leechcraft or herbalism. So it's roughly speaking 1400 years old or something like that. And the practices in there of tribal healers who use plants, you know, when you read about it, it's very clear that the types of practices they're using are really plant spirit medicine. They were clearly versed in the healing properties of the plants, but they related to them in an incredibly personal way as living beings. And in fact, pretty much all indigenous cultures around the world have done that. And if you look at our own folklore and the way that we talk about plants, we've always done that. So we talk about how, for example, it's a bad idea to cut down an elder tree without asking its permission. And once upon a time, people would say, well, actually, your grandmother might be living in that tree. And the illusion was that an old wise herb wife or a witch spirit might actually inhabit that tree after they'd passed on. And it would be a very good idea to ask them first. For example, as children, we were taught about the herb Robert, which grows in the hedgerows. It's a very common wild geranium. And in the West Country, we call it snake food. And we were told that if you pick the flowers, then snakes will come out of the leaves and bite you. So, again, that's not really referring to herbal properties as such or anything else. It's sort of treating the plant as a magical living presence that's got power. And if you mistreat it, maybe it will use that power in not such a positive way towards you as well. So the message there is to treat all plants with respect as living beings. And plant spirit medicine is a term that seems to be getting bandied around a lot right now. In part, I think, connected with the upsurgence in interest in indigenous practices involving ayahuasca and various entheogens and things like this. But the way I use the term plant spirit medicine is much broader than that, and it doesn't really touch on those things that much. It's much more about gaining a relationship with the plant kingdom and the fungi kingdom, indeed, that's all around us, and starting to come into a state of communication with all of the plants as if they're individual living beings.
Which they are,
of course. It comes from a worldview that basically says that everything has got consciousness. So they're living, they're not just biological systems. They have consciousness and they can respond to us. And if we treat them with respect and make the effort using a series of spiritual, some would say shamanic techniques, to open up our consciousness to them, that they will meet us halfway and show us better how they can be used. And in some cases, if the relationship is very strong, they will even step in and tell us how other plants can be used if they're not the plant for the job. And this is really dipping into the world of shamanism, but I honestly believe it's within the capacity of absolutely anybody if they open their mind and they open themselves to it. And what I aim to do, I'm actually going to be putting on a plant spirit medicine workshop here, and it's really just giving people the tools to go away and do it for themselves. And that part of it is a safe practice.
Because that's, of course, what Edward Batch did with his flower remedies, isn't it? He put them on his tongue and then deduced what they could do from there, as far as I remember.
That's exactly right. And it's also what a lot of herbalists do these days, actually, outside of the fraternities of medical herbalism, quietly when they're practicing, they'll go back to the ways of our medieval forefathers and they'll say, right, okay, I'll chew a little bit of this, just a tiny amount. I'll feel what it does in my body. Is it hot? Is it bitter? Is it drying? Where can I feel its action in my body? And with plant spirit medicine, we take that maybe a step further too. And very often it's not necessary to actually ingest the plant at all. Once one has built a relationship with the plant kingdom and worked on that, then really all you need to do is come into contact with it in a meditative state, in a focused, aware state with a quiet mind. Sometimes one of the things I'll do to help me to do this is just get a small amount of the plant and place it on my forehead, which is a very sensitive area. And some people would know this as the brow chakra area, if that's the sort of thing that interests you. And then just sit there, quiet my mind, and just sit there and feel what goes on. And very often you can feel exactly what's happening in your bodily systems, just as if you'd actually swallowed a piece of it, that you can tell quite quickly what it's going to do. I wouldn't use that to guide me solely in giving plants to other people, as, you know, you've got to be careful, you've got to apply science and you've got to use diagnosis and all the rest of it. But very often it has just been that little nudge that's nudged me in the right direction to know what to do.
I know, I remember, because I've read a lot of shamanic, there's something I've been reading since I was young, really, these shamanic and anthropological books. And I remember coming across again and again the idea that when the anthropologists aren't the shaman, where they got the idea for, say, the extremely complex chemical techniques needed to make ayahuasca, the shamans actually said to them, well, the plants told us, and it would appear that that's literally the case.
I completely concur. That's absolutely true. But then I think also, if you look at a lot of the greatest scientific discoveries that have ever been made, and you read about the scientists who came up with them, you often find they dreamt about the answer too.
Yeah, absolutely right. We've got a little bit more information from Rick about his Lady of the Woods fungus. It says it's a white fungus that grows out of old oak rotted trees. He's always known as Lady of the Forest, but it may be named something else. No, still drawing a blank there. There, Rick.
If we have a scientific name, we'd be well away.
Yeah, this is the thing with the Latin names, the ones that belong to the Pope, they're the ones that we need. Because the thing is that all plants have different common names, don't they, wherever it is. So, and here's another one from Rick. Have you heard of floracology? Hi there, John. Do come in when you're ready, mate. Yeah, floracology. See, no, that one's drawn a blank as well. Yeah, I also agree with Fred, by the way, about the Way of Weird. It is an absolutely fantastic book. I read that a long time ago, and it's recently been republished. It was difficult to get for a while, but ever so good that is. So perhaps just because we've got John Witterick now, he's just finished doing his talk, queued up on the doorstep, but perhaps you could say a little bit about the medicinal mushrooms you're going to be talking about.
Sure. I'm going to be doing a talk on medicinal mushrooms on Sunday evening at 10 p.m. So we're at the Green Gathering site. That'll be in the Stars and Stones Dome, which I can hardly pronounce. It doesn't roll off my tongue, which is a great little space. I'm going to be showing a couple of short videos. There's some time-lapse footage of fungi growing, and there'll be some explanation around that and the life cycle of fungi. There's also a great short video by the mycologist Paul Stamets, who really is heading up as a personality, a mycological revolution in the world at the moment. He's been doing research into transforming piles of crude oil into edible oyster mushroom patches, bioremediation that works in a very, very short time frame and leaves things in a food safe state, which is absolutely incredible. He's been cleaning up land on his own farm using mushroom cultures in ditches and cleaning up the runoff before it enters the rivers, and developing even mushroom strains that will clean up dangerous nerve gas residue on battlefields by developing specialized chemicals on their mycelium matrix that are actually the antidotes that will break down nerve gases like sarin, which is absolutely bizarre, but completely true. And this guy is a professor of mycology. He's a world-renowned figure. You know, everyone in the field knows him. So I'm going to be talking about some of his work. I'm also going to be talking about some of my own experience working with herbs in a curative sense to work with people and working with medicinal mushrooms. and I've got some samples of medicinal mushrooms with me. I'm going to be talking a lot about medicinal research around mushrooms, immunological studies, various cases where cancers were cured, huge population studies where they've been used to or noted to reduce the incidence of cancers, the use of mushrooms to treat certain types of tuberculosis, even the HIV virus. There's some really groundbreaking stuff coming out now. It's absolutely mind-blowing. It's stuff that 10 years ago we would have looked at as a bunch of fairy tales. And actually, once again, a lot of the stuff that came to us, knowledge from indigenous cultures, is proving to be scientifically correct and replicated in scientific studies. And the medical profession and the scientific community are taking it really seriously. So I want to get this knowledge out there. I think it's wonderful that that's happening, but I want this knowledge to be in the hands of the people, so that you're not going to, you're not going somewhere and paying a lot of money for something that you don't actually know where it comes from and it's got an unpronounceable name. These are things that we can go out, grow for ourselves, harvest from the forest, treat respectfully, and create medicines from. And in the vast majority of cases, the medicinal mushrooms that we use are not even significantly toxic. A lot of them are already used as foods. So that's what it's about.
That is absolutely fabulous. And of course, like you said earlier, that's one of mushrooms' fundamental jobs is clearing stuff up. I heard rumours, actually, that they're also managing to achieve a degree of bioremediation even from nuclear fallout and stuff with mushrooms. Are you aware of that?
I'm a little bit aware of this. There's been a bit of talk recently, and I think it's sort of more of a hypothesis than anything else, but there's been a bit of talk about stuff revolving around the area of the Chernobyl disaster, where fungi in particular seem to have done a really great job of recolonizing the landscape, and particularly in some of the most radioactive areas. And that may not be that surprising, because in some ways, lack of human intervention will just let nature take over. And albeit there will be some destructive effects from the radiation in terms of damage to DNA and things like this, but life being life, it will keep on being life if we don't interfere with it. However, one of the things that has been noticed is that a lot of fungi that accumulate the pigment melanin, which is the dark pigment in our skin, which protects our skin from solar radiation, the fungi that accumulate this pigment seem to be very prevalent in areas of high radiation. And some scientists have put forward a theory that the fungi themselves are using the pigment as a way of harvesting energy from the radiation, in the same way that plants use chlorophyll to harvest energy from sunlight. I think this is currently not proven, however, is starting to look more and more likely that it is the case.
That's absolutely marvellous, Fred. Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure talking to you, and I look forward to seeing some of the workshops. I've got little asterisks against all of yours. And we'll probably set synchro on you a bit later with the voice recorder to do perhaps another recorded interview. But thank you very much for joining us here in Cleggie's bus.
Thank you. Am I right giving myself a little plug?
Go for it.
If the sort of things I'm talking about are things that interest you, then you might like to take a look at my website, which is www.thewildsideoflife.co.uk. And I'm running courses and workshops in quite a few places around the country, but predominantly in the southwest. So if you're interested, do take a look.
Very good, yeah, I can thoroughly recommend that website. It's really great. And thanks a lot, Fred, once again. I shall just put a couple of tunes on whilst we warm up for John Whitrick, who's going to be talking with us about fraud and the illusion of debt, for a sudden change of subject. So we'll be back with you in 10 minutes or so, and I'll see you then. Hey, fabulous, eh? That was The Destroyers and a track called Server. Completely bonkers band. John Whitrick was saying that he's seen them down the square in Compass in Dorset. Before that, Crawling from the Wreckage, which we all are doing, from Dave Edmonds. God is a DJ, amongst other things, from Faceless. And the fabulous favourite of Dr. Rock, Horace X, playing Keeping the Upper Lip Stiff. So I'm joined by John now, who's fresh from action in the Avalon Rising tent here at the Green Gathering, where he's been endeavouring to give his latest talk, which is called Fraud, the Illusion of Debt. How did it go, John?
Well, Dr. Rock, it was great, actually. I started off when I walked into the tent to... I had one person there, but then three more turned up. And then as I was talking, just more and more people came in And yeah, by the time I was halfway through it, we had a good tentful. So yeah, it was good. I was a little bit down on energy this afternoon. I've been here since Sunday. I think you've been here since Saturday, weren't you? And you know, it's a lot of late nights. It's a lot of physical work as well. I've been carrying, you know, huge, great logs around and the usual sort of thing for setting up at Avalon Rising. But this year has been quite incredible. When we turned up, part of our space, which we call the Fairy Glade, which we turn into something magical and have been doing for 3 years. As you know, when I turned up and saw you, the first thing you said is the whole place has been trashed and it was full of broken glass. And, you know, we all felt really a little bit low that first day. However, my God, haven't we turned it round? It is now the most spectacular space, and it's better than it's ever been. In my opinion, it is just absolutely remarkable. The whole space is remarkable.
There will be some recorded interviews from the Green Gathering in next week's show, and they will hopefully be accompanied by a Dr. Rock slideshow showing you pictures of some of the stuff we're describing here.
Yeah, yeah. But now we've got the actual truck we're in is it's Phil's truck, Phil Cleggy, and he has put together the most amazing lighting. And he can get on his iPhone and change the colour of the oak tree just by running his finger across his iPhone. It is quite incredible, and it's great fun. And the whole place is lit up, and it's magical. It's absolutely magical. And this is why we, you know, brave the cold and come and live in fields for a week or so and spend loads and loads of time creating these wonderful structures and archways and a labyrinth, and all to be taken down in a few days. So it's people coming together having an absolutely amazing time. And the other thing, of course, is that I feel we're shifting stuff on a fundamental level by coming together and overcoming all the challenges that are placed before us.
So how did the talk go? Did you manage to get all... I mean, one of the things I really like about doing talks at gigs like this is that people can come to the door of the tent and then they can wander in, because, of course, they've already paid, whereas when you're doing a ticket entry gig, you tend to start with the number of people you've got, one or two stray people. But people do come, don't they? They hang around in the door a bit, and then it's some speakers scare them away, although not many at Avalon Rising, whereas for other people, you just slowly but surely see the space fill up, which leads to a better performance, I think.
Yeah, I think very much so. They actually vote with their feet. And if you're not giving them what they want, they walk out. But yeah, it was really nice. I started off with a bit of a graveyard shift because all our crew were eating. And most people were wandering off to go and see bands and things like that. But as I say, I started off. And when I was halfway through, the place was pretty well half full. And more people came as we spoke. What was interesting, excuse me, I'm just going to have a little swig of, oh dear, it's American lager, I'm sorry about that. But yeah, halfway through, a couple of people from the campaign section came up, and they're a little bit sort of not separate from us, because we don't have anyone separate from us. But they do have a slightly different mindset, and this is something I was talking about to you, good doctor. And one of them sort of said, well, do you think it's... I was talking about a banking system being designed to take our wealth from us. And he said, oh, is that conspiracy or is it just cock-up? And I said, well, personally, you know, I don't like the word conspiracy. I like the word truth. But I personally think that the financial system is designed just like the game of Monopoly. And the game of Monopoly is where you know, the object of the game of Monopoly is to bankrupt all your opponents. And that is exactly what is going on at the moment. But they have to keep it on a knife edge, because if the game of Monopoly finishes too early, if you bankrupt all your opponents, you haven't got anyone to play with, and you bankrupt yourself. So what they have to do is keep the actual international banking system on a knife edge, whereby it can still continue to function, but they steal as much wealth as possible. And they do that by quantitative easing and just chucking loads and loads of money in. Because I say it's like musical chairs. If you know, if everyone gets up and dances and somebody takes a couple of chairs away, somebody's going to be sat on the floor. And it's the same with the money, financial system. If they're creating money out of nothing, then every time they inflate the monetary supply and then charge interest, you know, on those loans, what they call loans, they're not loans, and then people default. Now, if too many people default too quickly, it'll bring the whole system down. So it was quite interesting. But, you know, I was also talking about how I feel we're going through a shift, and that people are waking up to what's going on. And what I really feel is that as people are waking up, as the system is collapsing, people are waking up. And when it does collapse, we will have the answers to actually wake up. And that gives us a huge opportunity to actually put something in place that does work for everyone. Now, unfortunately, the two people out of everyone in the audience, there were two people that, I mean, they were lovely people. They weren't attacking me at all. It's just that they didn't believe. They were so focused on the problems, they couldn't actually see the solutions. And I said at one point, I said, well, I feel that we are going through, oh, sorry, one lady actually said to me, she said, oh, it's happened over and over again. And, you know, all the governments are the same, you know, and it just seems to go round and round, and we've never solved this problem. I said, now we are at a time in history that we've never experienced before. All the indigenous tribes knew of a time when we would go through a shift. The Hopis told, I mean, the Mayans gave us a date 2 years ago. And I thought that in 2012 there was going to be a huge shift. But by February 2013, I could feel the difference. I could feel, hang on, it doesn't feel the same anymore. And now that we're in, what year are we in now? 2014. They seem to go by so quickly. Things are really changing. And at so many levels, the fact that some of the most sordid details of what our elected politicians have been doing, certainly to do with things like children's home, these things are now coming out, and those things would have been hidden and wouldn't have been actually shared before.
Yeah, I know when Jonathan Kaner was here, was at the Green Gathering last year, he was, and he's here again this year, looking forward to him, he was saying that we have to bear in mind that, that 10 years ago, policemen, priests, teachers, doctors were all regarded with deep and more or less kind of universal respect, if you like, and entertainers, stars, all of that. And now all of that has changed. We are no longer willing to turn our eyes away from the things that we were willing to ignore all that time ago. And it does seem to me that people are, and that's a sign that more people are waking up. I thought the analogy you were giving earlier when we were talking privately about the wake-up time, maybe you'd like to...
Yeah. Well, the lady that said, well, I can't see things are changing, and it still seems to be the same, and it goes on, and all I see in the newspapers are things getting worse and worse and worse. I mean, obviously, there are things like these mad killings, like at Sandy Hook, where we realise that we look at the newspaper and see some idiot supposedly, you know, murdering loads and loads of children, when in fact, when you actually look at the whole details, there weren't any children that were actually shot, and that all the people involved with it were actors. this is the whole thing. So, and as I alluded to you earlier, I said to this lady, I said that at 6 o'clock this morning, most of us were fast asleep. There are one or two, like, there are probably a couple of mums that got woken up by the kids and had to feed them and things like that. And there are probably guys that have been partying all night, and as I did on, I think, the Saturday night last year at Green Gathering, where I suddenly realised, oh my God, it's daylight and it's 6 o'clock. I haven't been to bed, but it was a good night. And but by 9 o'clock, probably about half of us were awake and getting up, and it's just a cycle. It's just a cycle. We tend to, when it's night, we go to sleep. Now, we've been asleep for a long, long time. And whilst we were asleep, there are a few people that started taking advantage of us. And now is the time that we're waking up. And we're waking up en masse. And it's not just us guys in fields with, you know, most of us with scraggly beards. And, you know, some of us are slightly long hair. Some, you know, it's not just us crusty hippies, you know, and people in fields that are waking up. But policemen, politicians, newspaper reporters, it's going across. Now, it's slightly slower for a lot of them, but by 10 o'clock this morning, most of us were awake. A couple of people having a lie-in, despite the noise and the heat and everything else. But this is it, and we're going through this cycle. And as I said earlier, the Mayans and the Hopis, so many indigenous tribes knew that this time was very, very special. And the Mayans gave us the date within, you know, months as to when. And I did feel, as I said, February 2013, I think it feels different. It really does.
It is interesting, isn't it, how the people in the campaign area at Sill seem to be stuck with the idea that protesting against something is somehow effective, whilst themselves, as you said, acknowledging that no progress has been made ever, as far as they can see. Whereas what we're definitely doing at Avalon Rising and at People's Internet Radio is seeking solutions to the thing. And what you were trying to do was bring to people's attention the nature of the fraud that's being perpetrated. And we know from your get out of free webs, get out of free.org website, we know that there's easy ways, because you quite rightly said to these people, their job, their aim is to try and bankrupt you, your aim is to try to stop them. And yet they somehow, as far as I can gather, actually managed to not derail your talk, but force you effectively to deal with them and a protest point of view rather than coming out with the solution. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, I got halfway through the talk, and normally I'm very boundaried when I'm talking, because it's very easy for one person to derail your talk. But I started off with slightly different boundaries because I had so few people in at the beginning of the talk that I went in, rather than sat at the microphone and being next to the computer, I sat in front of them and wanted them to respond. But as more people came in, I was still had the boundaries completely open. So, but I could have put them back into check and said, right, no, I want to carry on with the slideshow and then I'll take questions at the end. And if you want to make a quick comment, just raise your hand. And if I have time, I'll respond. But from what, and there were two people involved, and from what they said, I had to there and then address what they were saying. And I stopped the slideshow completely. But the good thing is I'd done the what I tried to explain the financial system, and the rest of the stuff was stuff they could find out on the website. So I said to anyone, well, look, if you want to find out the remedy, just get on to Get Out Debt Free. And what was lovely, I also got on the slide. At the end, what I did, I asked, somebody asked me a question and I deflected it to Dave Murphy, who's, you know, could answer the question. And it gave me a chance to actually jump to a slide, which I could do, so I could wrap the actual talk up. But no, it's fun. And the slide was how in 2009, all the debt collectors got together in a meeting actually decided that there were five websites that they wanted to remove from the internet. And one of them was a penalty charge forum, consumer action group, a lot of these other websites, and of course get out of debt free. And I can remember the day very clearly because I got a phone call from the from my mate who helps me with the coding and the website and does the servers. He said, bloody hell, what's going on? He said, the servers have almost crashed. We've had so much traffic today. So I got online trying to work out what was going on. And the Guardian had reported this story, and a Guardian is in the, I think it's the top five or top 10 sites for traffic in the UK. Now, they had reported the story and also put in a hyperlink to all the sites that were... Now, our Google ranking went, in one day, we were languishing on page 4. I remember, if you want to bury a dead body, page 2 of Google's perfectly okay. And we went straight on to page 1 of Google in one day with the amount of traffic, because Google responds pretty quickly. And within a month or so of that actually arising, of them trying to attack us, that actually pushed the website rankings through the ceiling. And within a month of that happening, we were at number 1 for a lot of search terms around debt. And now we have between 4,000 and 5,000 people a day. That's individual visitors, not hits, not page views or anything like that. That's unique visitors, 4,000 or 5,000 a day.
And if you haven't been to see getoutofdebtfree.org recently, then do go and have a look at it. It's looking well flash and convincing and really corporate. But, man, it's like the opposite of corporate. It's really great. So do you reckon, John, that you and I should go up to the campaigns area and try doing some interviews for the show?
Bloody right. Yeah, I think a lot of these people, they are really, really well-meaning. And I think I fell into it a little bit with the whole Freeman thing, where I was trying to beat the system. And you're talking about protesting earlier. The people that protest the most are 2-3-year-olds, isn't it? Because what they do, they go, no, you've got to do this. They go, no, they won't. I won't do it. I won't do it. Once they get a little bit older, they comply a little bit better. And, you know, it can be, and you can, but the people that protest are the toddlers. They're the ones that will say, no, I won't do it. By the time they're teenagers, they'll just sort of like give you a load of crap and sort of like, but they won't protest. And as adults, why would we be protesting? And what I say is, I don't want to play your game. I know your game. It's like, it's Monopoly. And all you're trying to do is take my wealth from me. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to build myself a yurt, or I'll live in a caravan, or I'll live in a tent, but I'm not going to play your game anymore. And we'll go and play somewhere else. And your system will become redundant as people walk away from it. So I'm not going to fight you anymore. And I think some of the people in the campaign area are so focused on what is wrong that they can't see what is unfolding perfectly, and they're not seeing this shift in consciousness where people are waking up. And I feel that very strongly.
And of course, protest is ceding jurisdiction, isn't it? It's letting them know that you think they've got the power and the influence. Whereas, yeah, my approach as well, like yours, is to work out what it is that you think they're doing, do a 180 and make energetic progress in the other direction, which is, I think, really what you're doing. And it's really great to have spoken to you again. We'll catch up with you with a voice recorder and maybe go up to the campaign area as well and see if we can get some sense out of them. And thanks a lot, John. It's really brilliant to chat with you.
Dr. Rock, it's been a pleasure as always. Thanks a lot.
I'll catch you later. John's been working really hard tonight, so I think we should let him get out there and tackle another can of beer. And if you can find one for me whilst you're out there, that'd be really great.
My last one. I've got a bottle of wine.
Oh, well, yeah, I think that might be a bit iffy, bottle of wine. Brilliant, John. I'll see you later. I've got my last two guests for the night lined up here. I'll put on a couple of tunes whilst we get settled in here. So here comes Catatonia and Strange Glue. Yay, don't bogart that joint from Country Joe and the Fish there. One of my favourites. I'm sure there'll be a chance for non-bogarting a little spliffy later on in the evening. This is, alas, a no-smoking area. Before that, Catatonia, and it was a strange glue that held us together from their International Velvet album, an album which, in my opinion, has not a bad track on it, and I have no idea what happened to them after that, but hey, that's the way of things, isn't it? So I'm joined by Pet... And Matt. Pet's going to be talking about sound healing and chakra balancing and stuff. And Matt's going to be talking about his quest for English love stories to tell with people and how important the love stories are to us. So we're going to start off with you, Pet. Thank you very much for joining us. What are you going to be doing for us this weekend?
Well, now, good question. Hello. What I'm going to be doing is I've developed this thing which is an immersive sound experience. So there's a couple of things we're talking about there. We talk about sounds, obviously, which is really important. And we also talk about space. And there's been some really interesting studies about the idea that your body knows things and can process things before your mind can understand it. And it's called haptic. So I'm really interested in this full immersion in sound and healing sound, although that's a bit of an odd word. So I'm going to be doing a couple of things. One is I'm going to be doing a Shruti box meditation where we work through our chakras, starting at the base chakra, going through to the crown and then back down again. And I just find that the Shruti box is a really, really powerful and very still meditative tool. Because it's just a single drone. And it's really interesting when you work with a drone, because I've worked as a musician and a singer for years and years and worked with musicians from the Guildhall and like all over the world, really amazing people. And you ask them to just drone one note for longer than 3 minutes and it's an incredibly difficult task. So to hold that with the intention and work really deeply into one note very, very simply is actually something that's quite difficult to do.
The Shruti box is a kind of old-style accordion without any keys. Is that, am I thinking of the right machine?
Yeah, it's kind of like a little pump kind of organ, yeah. It was originally a piped instrument that was Chinese, and then the Indians developed it into this sort of squeeze box type thing, you know. So it's a bit like a honk. In a very basic, normal scale. And I think mine's a bit flat. But actually, I'm quite happy about that because I'm not too keen on sort of perfect tuning.
Well, when we were talking to Tim Wheater the other week, he was telling us that we should be working 8 hertz down from where we are. So if it's completely the right amount of hertz flat, then that's great. So you can play different notes on them. And do you use different notes for different chakras?
Yeah, well, there are so many different ideas, so many different philosophies, and so many different ideas. Obviously, there always is, isn't there? But I just work from a basis that really works for me. So I think it's Jonathan Goldman has this idea that you can tune your chakras and there's a certain note that tunes particular ones. C is the base chakra. But I don't know. To be honest, the jury's out on everything for me. It's just my thing is experience, so whatever I experience to be true, then I sort of try and share that. But I do find F really opens my heart, and we've done F meditations on Valentine's Days in quite auspicious churches and places in Avebury, and we've literally walked out after just droning on F for 10 minutes, feeling like our feet are pointing outwards and our chest has been butterflied by the butcher's knife, you know. So, yeah, it's sort of powerful stuff, but I'm very, very much more into the intuition of it and the intention as well. Some people are really anti-intention, but, yeah.
How do you find people respond to these treatments? Because you've obviously been doing a fair bit of it now. I'm looking forward to seeing what it's like.
I've worked with it a lot. I've worked at the Barbican Theatre with it and developed it at a theatre in in London because I was really interested in introducing alternative things to people that wouldn't usually see them. And we got a really interesting write-up in The Guardian sort of saying, should there be a health warning with art? And that is the best review I've ever had, because I've been a musician for a really long time and people have always said really glowing things. But actually, that's a brilliant question. That is an amazing question. I mean, we want things to change our lives, but actually, do we? You know, and I'm really, 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 really interested in sound aiding transition than this transition that we're all talking about and we're all experiencing.
So how long ago did you make the transition from kind of musician to healer?
Well, I think maybe about 7 years ago, yeah. But to be honest, I've always been singing in a really connected way, in a sort of spiritual way. I've been singing from my soul, and it's taken until I was 43 to sort of understand what that is and actually have some faith in what that is. So I've always been doing that, but now I've just started doing it mainly for other people. It took a long time to work out, you know, who I was and what I was doing, and that was an essential analysis, you know, of how to be a better person. It sounds cheesy, but it's true, you know.
And do you find you're developing, as you encounter individual people, do you find that you're developing different techniques for dealing with them?
Yeah, definitely. My experience is I've been doing a lot of shamanic work recently, and I've found that that's really, really my soul path. So it's sort of, it's really interesting that everything is really coming together. So the sound has now become a sort of shamanic sound. And then 2 weeks ago, I started using plant spirit medicine as well. So it seems like everything, so the spirit work and the sound work and the plant medicine work, is all becoming the same thing, and it's incredibly powerful, really, really powerful. And you know, I was a complete skeptic, and I became unwell, and I read in a psychologist magazine about sound healing and thought, oh, what the fuck's that? That's a bit too out there for me, you know. And I went to one session and I just felt like I'd been hit by a truck, and I swear I'd never slept like that in my life. And like 3 weeks later, I just signed up, you know. So
what sort of sound healing did you experience when you went to investigate something about which you were cynical?
Yeah, it was voice. So it was just voice. It was someone toning over my body and scanning for blockages, and then singing into those spots to release the, you know, whatever it is, the blocked emotion or the anxiety or, you know, whatever it was. And it just really worked for me, and I'm just interested in sharing that. And if it works for people, you know, great.
Well, it is all resonance, isn't it? It's all frequency. And have you encountered Tim Wheater yet?
I haven't, no.
Well, we had him on the show a few weeks back talking about the detuning of our scale. And I think he's doing 3 or 4 sessions here. And he does toning, I think. I'm not sure he's got the weird old squeeze box whose name I've forgotten already. But he does play, he plays these Andean flutes and things. And he does a lot of toning. I actually went to a music medicine festival, and like you, this is in Glastonbury, I wasn't too sure. I was crewing, I knew I'd enjoy that, but I wasn't too sure about the whole thing. But actually, I had a fabulous weekend. So where did you the sound healing you had sorted you out straight away, or did you have to go for?
Well, it began a process, but what it was kind of a bit like being hit in the back of the head with a spade, you know. It was such a wake up. But I suppose, you know, because sound has always been my thing anyway. So I was and I was really ready to move, and I was ready to change, and I was ready to heal. And I'd done a lot of work on myself already, but I have a lot of clients, you know, and I give them one and they're like, you don't really, you have one of those in your lifetime. And, you know, one sort of healing treatment like that, that really is an incredibly powerful catalyst. And I just want to say something about the scales, because this is something that's out on the jury for me, because scales are so complex as well. And in the West, they're so different from the East. And I've been working a lot with Michael Ormiston. He's a Mongolian throat singer. He's like one of the only people, Westerners, that are blessed to teach Mongolian singing in England. And he's a really, really incredible man. And we made this piece together that we're going to be playing, just playing back on Sunday night, I think, 8 o'clock, and tomorrow at 8 o'clock. And And the Mongolians don't have a scale. Mm. They tune to themselves. Yeah. So that's really interesting. Mm. And also our Western scale is so sharp now. So this is the 8 hertz that your man's talking about detuning to because of the main fiddle player, violin player in orchestras. They always tune themselves sharp to stand out from the rest of the orchestra. So over time, it's all changed. So it's us that keeps changing it. So
What Tim was saying was that we've got this 440A that we're playing to, but he also described a thing called the Solvaggio, which is a different scale, much higher, that has been used by orchestras, he said, especially in Germany, because it makes the fiddles and everything sound a lot brighter, but it's really challenging to the voice. But what Jess said, Synchro said to me, was that the Solvaggio was what they used to use in the chapels in Wales, and they used to, instead of having the music written on the stage, they used to have do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do as the notes, so they'd sing the note that was associated with it. But yeah, I accept what you're saying about the Indian tuning and all of that, but I still find it amazing that it was Goebbels who managed to change all of the Western stuff at a stroke. It's amazing, isn't it, how often... I like the idea of you're taking your stuff into theatres and putting it in front of people who just ain't expecting it. Because as your experience suggests, it's quite often, isn't it, a crisis that forces us to seek new things rather than just having it put in front of us.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm not sure whether it's sort of deviant on my behalf or whether it's my part of activism. You know, I used to write songs and I was always trying to be an activist and sort of stand behind my beliefs, but sometimes it's really good for us, you know. And there is this philosophy that we, you know, the people that sort of consciousness is slightly higher raised at the moment are really there to help people through this period of change, and it's hard. Shit, it's hard, you know. And been going through it for a long time now, but you know, there's just recently I've been having calls from old school friends that I haven't seen for, like, you know, 25 years, and they're like, can you help? And I'm like, of course I can, you know, because maybe I've been going through it a bit long with the music business. Everything crashed years ago, so our economic thing, just the production of CDs and digital music, was just really changed.
Did you find, because quite often when you have this kind of crisis change that comes about as a result of illness and an encounter with, say, something like sound healing, or for everybody the encounter's different, that after that everything else starts changing as well? Did that happen for you?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's crisis management. Everything changes, doesn't it? And it's really interesting. Friends around you aren't that keen on you changing. No, like your mum. What do you mean there's nothing wrong with you anymore? You're not singing blues songs anymore.
Very good. Talking of the blues, Nick Nomix put in there that good blues guitarists usually tune themselves slightly flat.
Yeah, I always sing flat. Yeah, mine are all naturally flat. My guitar's tuned.
He says, laughed out loud, like being hit on the back of a head with a spade. Sounds like the feeling I had when I first saw the Cardiacs play. Yeah. Well, that's very good.
About punk at a heart level.
Yeah. That's very good, yeah. Well, thanks very much for joining us, Pat. That was great. I'll look forward to coming and seeing what you're doing, brilliant, which I will.
It's
really great. Thanks a lot. So we'll move over to a very unusual subject. I mean, Dr. Rock's covered everything from badger culls through illegal mortgages to the nature of consciousness, but now we're going to dig into love stories. Yes, you heard it here. So so Matt, what's your mission, mate?
Well, hi, yeah, thanks. I was writing an album, a music album, and we were recording it in an old rural church, and as we sat there recording it, people would sort of drift in and they'd sit down and they'd listen as we played, and we'd get into conversations with these people. And when I came to the end of the album, the recording, I was trying to work out how I wanted to tour it and how I wanted to take it out there. And I remembered these sort of experiences we had together, these sort of conversations about the music and what was going on. I wanted to take that further. I wanted to sort of go out. I wanted to walk. And I just wanted to find my way through the countryside. And my album, I suppose, was my love story of sorts. And I wanted to share that, and I wanted to hear other people's at the same time. And I started to read about love and love stories, and I started to find that, you know, for me and for a lot of people, our love stories describe moments in our life where we feel profoundly human. And it might last 10 seconds, and it might last 10 years, and it might be incredibly sad, or it might be incredibly joyful. But at those moments in our lives, we are profoundly human. So when we share those moments, and when we talk, and when we express them to each other, we're sharing something of ourselves on our deepest, deepest level. And in that way, we start to build community, you know, in the sense of from the word communitas, which is sharing of feelings and emotions. And I wanted to go in England. I want to talk to English people and see if English people could do that. If that, you know, because we have this reputation for being very sort of stoical and, you know, straight and not wanting to share. But, you know, you get out there and you walk out, and that's what I do. So I take a bag, I take a guitar, and I walk, and I meet people on the path and meet them in pubs and chapels, and we visited prisons. And you find that everyone's love story is amazingly profound and powerful, and it changes people. And it really can start a revolution within them. And it's what Petra's talking about. And it's what we've just been hearing about with debt. It's all about the same thing. It's about people rooting themselves in something different, in a different way. Yeah. And in talking about our love stories, I really believe that if we can share that, and then we can start to talk about loving interactions, then we can start to base everything from that place.
Yeah. And it seems to me like the kind of, as well as playing the Monopoly that John was talking about, the system that we find ourselves encountering is working very hard at separating people from other people and dehumanising us to the point where what's been going on in Palestine recently has been going on for years with nothing being done about it and nobody being outraged. Do you think the love story thing is maybe helping remind people to rehumanise them, if you like?
Well, I can give you two examples of it. And one is about Palestine, where I was there about a month ago. And the other was when I went to prison and I asked prisoners to share their love stories, and I asked them what their love stories might be. And there's the love stories on the outside that they have, and there's the love stories that they now experience every day. And what they experience every day as a love story is might be a smile, right, or might be someone opening or holding a door open for them, and that is it. Because prison is built to dehumanise. It's the antithesis of love. It's the antithesis, it's the end game. Yeah. It's horrific. And Palestine and the Gaza Strip is a prison on a big scale. And it has the same thing. And the fact that that is going on and so many people can be ambivalent. I saw a photo of the UN resolutions, you know, that it went around Facebook quite a lot. And they had people who had said yes and no, and people who abstained. And it's just horrific, you know, that there's people like England, France abstaining, people like Japan abstaining, the US obviously not accepting it at all. But it's all, you know, it's on a small level. But if we start talking from our hearts, if we can share something of ourselves, then we completely negate that conversation. Because we're saying, that's the way you do it. That's your shit. You can do that. But we're going to start from here. It's about how we love. And everything builds and circles from there. So although I tell people I walk around the country gathering love stories, and lots of people go, oh, that's so sweet. That's really lovely. But you know what? It is sweet and it's really lovely, but it's also really powerful stuff. And I believe it can change the world. I really do, yeah.
So is this finding its way into your music or into writing? How's it kind of changing the way you do things?
Yeah, my life is changing every day as everything's happening for everyone. And in terms of my music, I haven't been able to write a thing since writing that album and since doing this, and I'm not too sure why. I think it's because before I was completely filled with sort of angst and desire and yearning for this experience I'd never had, and I just tasting some of that experience, I don't know what to write about now. not very good at writing happy tunes. I've got to work out something else. So the music has gone, but part of the project is we record the stories and we archive them. There's a living archive which you can go to. It's an englishlovestory.info. And on there at any time we have about 50 love stories, which are all different. Some are, you know, people talk for a while once they get going, so we edit them down, but they can be up to 7 minutes or 1 minute, but it's the essence of their stories, and you can hear them and people share them. So, and it's amazing. What is really surprising is the places it gets listened to, which is obviously UK, US, but our second most listened to place is Egypt and Iran, Iraq, all Middle Eastern places. It's fascinating, the countries, because I wanted to go to Palestine and I was told explicitly it's a really difficult place to go to do that because they won't talk about those things. And yet these are the countries that are really actually tuning in and listening. So they want to. But, yeah, that's fascinating.
So if I was to ask you what the most memorable love story you've heard over the time, which one would any of them spring to mind, or am I going to have to fill time whilst it kind of seeps in between your ears?
Well, I'd have to say, I can say a couple, but every single one is profoundly memorable. Everyone is beautiful. Everyone is really sad. I met one guy when I was walking on the hills, had his dog, and his dog was running off in the distance, sort of gnawing on someone's ankle. And I told him what I was doing, and he said, well, this is my love story. He goes, I walk from here, and I walk up to there, and I walk over there, and then I come back here, and then I go home. He goes, and that's the only way I can remember my wife. He said, I can't remember her any other way anymore. So that was one love story. I know, it's so sad, but also joyful. Another one, I think, was one of the guys in prison when I asked him what his love story was. And he said, well, this is my love story. And it was his mate, this massive, great, 6'8" oaf. And he just put his hand on him and went, thanks, mate. He goes, well, you know, he looks out for me. And that's it. So, but that was incredible.
Yeah, I was watching an old sci-fi series the other night, and one of the lines in it, there's a lot of good bits of scripting in it, but one of the lines in it said, if we're going to unpack the fear, we have to unpack the hatred.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And of course, that is what's going to lead us to love. And I think it sounds like a fantastic, simple kind of solution to bring to people's minds, mm-hmm. and then to share the information about what people are loving and how they are close to each other.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. Yeah, you got it.
Yeah. Well, that's really brilliant. I look forward to hearing you as well. I'm never going to make it out of Avalon Rising. I've got to catch some bands as well, but you've just given me a couple of CDs, which is really great.
Enjoy that.
So, 10 seconds. Yeah, yeah. Here it is, Mr. John Wishwick. He's come back for an encore.
What I really noticed there was the fact that I was talking about debt and you were talking about love stories, but the conclusion is pretty well the same, is that we're coming from, when you come from something heart-based, then all the solutions seem to just fall into place, don't they? And that's all I was going to say. Thank you very much. Totally. It's what we've all got a different story, but because when we all come from a heart-based point of view, the story's the same. And there's no them and us, and there's no problem, because any problem that's out there is something in yourself that hasn't been healed. And so it's coming up in our external selves, both individually and collectively. So, thank you.
Thanks for that, John. That seems like a really good place to end the talky bit. there you go. No, profound's what we like at this time of night. And, of course, that's what we're all doing here. We're putting all this work in from the heart. Nobody here is getting paid. There are probably some people who make a bit of money, but it won't be very much, and it's only imaginary money anyway. We've got Avalon Rising have a crew of 50 people here, and they're all doing what they're doing for the love of it and for the people, the love of the people they're doing it for. So in a way, what's going on here is a love story as well. So we've got more. I'd like to thank all of my guests. I'd like to thank Matt and Pat and John and Fred and Natasha and Nolan for coming on and sharing their thoughts. We've got lots of other things going on. Sean's out there doing his learning how to use dowsing rods and meeting with fairies and how to speed date douse with heart resonance. That sounds like quite an interesting one. We've got Hugh Newman talking about mounds, megaliths and giants, who really built the ancient sites. We've got Serena Roney Dougal, who's been on the show. She's talking about exploring consciousness and east-west perspective. As I said, Tim Weiser's here. He's going to be doing some sound work with us. Jonathan Kaner's back, the seven greatest secrets of the universe. Stephen Giross, who's also been on the show, he's here talking machines of the ancients. So, and that's just one of our venues, that is. I shall be working my way through these various places and trying to grab, this time round, I'm looking to grab 15 or 20 minutes with as many people as I can so that we can do another show or two from the Avalon Rising Arena at the Green Gathering, because I think there's going to be a lot of great stuff said. And like I say, hopefully me and John will neck a couple of beers and go up and stir it up in the campaign area a little bit. We've got 10 minutes or so of the show left before I get to go out and see if I can't find a joint to bogart in. I'll see you all next week. Don't know where I'll be. Probably be more stuff from the Green Gathering. In the meantime, we'll play out with the night we nearly got busted by the Alabama 3, and Bentley's going to sort you out from Bentley's Rhythm Ace. So thanks to all of you for being out there. Thanks to People's Internet Radio for still putting up with me, and my profound apologies for not being with you last week when, for some reason, my broadcast having worked perfectly all right before just went completely tits up. But do you know what? We managed to install it all, and it worked first time this time. So get into grips with the technobobble down here at the surgery. We'll see you all again soon. And remember, the light at the end of the tunnel may be you.